Mr. Singing.
You have a good voice.
House Committee on Revenue for the 11th day of June will come to order. Colleagues, I'd like to open a work session on HGR 21 first. Let me simply note that this is a constitutional amendment that would establish a minimum base tax at the counties of $2 per thousand. If assessed, the bill needs to go to the Rules Committee, and I would entertain a motion to move it to the Rules Committee without recommendation. Representative Vega Peterson.
Chair Barnhart, I move HJR 21, thank you, without recommendation and be referred to the House Committee on Rules by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson moves HJR 21 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules. Any discussion? I think we'll call the roll.
Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bettis?
No.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. With that, the motion carries. The bill goes to the Rules Committee. And we'll close the work session on HGR 21 and open a work session on House Bill 2089. Who's going to introduce that? There we are. Colleagues, I'll note there's a dash 2 amendment, which I think replaces the bill, and that's what we're going to talk about today. We'd like to hear from the department.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2089 would allow an individual who meets a certain criteria to apply for a suspended collection status if they are owing taxes to the Department of Revenue. The criteria would be that they have income that does not exceed 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. They have less than $5,000 in assets, and they would have income solely from a source that's exempt from garnishment under ORS Chapter 18. The measure requires the department to continue to charge interest on the taxes for which the collection has been suspended, and provides that the taxpayer may still make voluntary payments of any unpaid tax. It allows the department to file a lien against the taxpayer's property and to resume collection if the taxpayer were to incur additional unpaid tax during the period of suspended collection. It allows the department to offset any payments from state or federal government, including tax refunds, against the taxes that have been suspended. And it requires the department to annually review the taxpayer's eligibility for suspension and to reinstate collections if the criteria for suspension are not met. The measure is found to have a minimal fiscal impact, and as well as a minimal revenue impact. The reason being that the individual would have to have the type of income that's exempt from garnishment, and so they probably wouldn't be able to garnish from them anyway. But there could be limited cases in which this may reduce revenue slightly, or not having collection against them, individuals may be slightly less likely to make voluntary payments, but the effect is considered to be minimal.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you. For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2089-2. I've prepared written testimony, which is posted to OLIS, discussing some of our collection tools that are mentioned in the bill, and I'm prepared to answer any questions you have about that, so I won't repeat it here. But I did want to point out some of the points about our collection practices generally. So we are responsible to collect over about $1 billion of the money that is owed to the state. In our collection practices, we strive to be fair but firm when we collect the debt that is lawfully owed to the state, and we use the various tools that we have available to us judiciously. That said, I want to share some, I want to share that, one, we don't knowingly garnish exempt income. We simply have to turn it back around and give it back to the taxpayer if we did. So we want to avoid it happening whenever we can. And I think you'll see from the statistics in the posted testimony that we have 0.13% of garnishments actually have funds returned to taxpayers for exempt reasons. It's very, very small. When we issue a garnishment, we don't know if the exempt assets are in the account until either the bank tells us so or the taxpayer tells us so. We don't know what is the contents are in a bank account. If we receive exempt funds, we do return them to the taxpayer. In 2009, the legislature enacted Senate Bill 731 that allows financial institutions to not send exempt funds to a garnisher if the source of the income in the account is reasonably identifiable. That means if the financial institution can tell from their own records that the money in the account is from a source of income that is protected from garnishment, they do not send it. An excellent example of that is Social Security income, which is required to be direct deposited and is clearly identifiable. This is true for any collector. Taxpayers with only exempt income are still legally responsible for paying tax debt they've previously incurred. If a person doesn't have any non-exempt income or assets and they can't pay their debt right now, that doesn't absolve them of their existing tax liability. Although some individuals have only limited income now, their tax debt didn't accumulate from income like Social Security, which is neither taxable or garnishable. We allow for retention of reasonable living expenses under federal guidelines and abide by statutorily defined rules on collecting money owed to the state, but ultimately that debt is still owed. We're taking steps that, as I have testified previously, to better inform taxpayers of income that is exempt from garnishment. We've updated our notice and demand for payment letter and the brochure entitled Your Rights as an Oregon Taxpayer and posted that to our website, that form, to make taxpayers more aware of the laws addressing exempt income and assets. We are also creating a new document that explains the collection process overall. In addition, we are currently working on converting our current tax processing, accounting, and collection systems for the personal income tax program during 2015 to a new computer system. As part of that computer system, we have increased flexibility in the presentation and readability of our notices, so we are taking the opportunity to update them. As I displayed, I think, in House Bill 3172, I showed some examples of those in that testimony. All of these changes will be reported to the House Interim Committee on Revenue during the legislative interim, as requested by Representative Barnhart in that hearing. Additionally, we are searching for a vendor to give empathy training to our collectors, as well as training about adult communication needs. We've identified someone, and we're piloting that now. We basically want to work with anyone with tax debt so that we can work on their specific situation. We need to have the conversation with them so that we can help them work through these difficult situations they're in. We typically issue garnishments when taxpayers don't respond to our notices or our phone calls, or they don't meet their agreed upon payment agreements. We're legally required to proceed with collection actions. Additionally, as most of you are aware, tax return information is confidential under 314.835. So if the taxpayer wants another person to represent them in any tax matter, they must complete the form, tax information authorization and power of attorney for representation to us. We cannot share information with anyone unless and until the taxpayer authorizes us to do so. A violation of this law is punishable as a Class C felony and termination from public employment for a period of 5 years. If the department asks the taxpayer to complete that form, it is imperative that the taxpayer do so timely so that we can work with the taxpayer, work with the person the taxpayer has designated. Finally, a challenge to the garnishment isn't about the validity of the debt. Even an approved challenge to a garnishment doesn't mean that the debt we're trying to collect is invalid. Certain income and assets like Social Security and other federal benefit payments or child support, spousal support can't be garnished to help pay a state tax debt. The debt remains owing, though, even if a garnishment challenge is approved. So with that, I'm willing to take any questions you have about either my written or my oral testimony.
Thank you very much. Questions on this or the dash two? Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair. And Dana, thank you very much for your testimony. I wonder if you could speak to both the existing ability for the department to write off or cancel debt, mm-hmm. and the additional authority that the dash two amendments would provide. And if you could just give us an idea of what circumstances would exist whereby the department would take that step to move a taxpayer either into a non-collectible status or write off the debt or cancel the debt.
So in my testimony, it's posted online on page, well, the bill addresses the, gives us some specific guidance on what would be considered temporarily or suspended collections, temporarily uncollectible. Current law, and if you look at page two, or excuse me,
well, and what you just said is new authority for you.
Well,
isn't it?
We do that now because it's in the best interest of everyone to allow someone. The most common example is if someone loses their job, they're on unemployment, they tell us, and we put them into a six-month hold status. We say, we'll check back with you. We'll check employment records to see if there's a garnishment source, if they have started working, and we'll contact them and say, hey, I see you've got another job. Why don't you set up a payment plan? Excuse me. But to answer your question about the specific write-off and cancellation, the criteria is on page three of my testimony. And we do actively move them. In fact, the legislature, I think, gave us some funding to have people actively work on this because sometimes it's a little more complex. But my understanding with the new system, they're going to automate these business rules so that a person won't actually have to look to see if they're eligible for this. They're going to hit that timeline, and they're going to move into that status. They're going to hit a seven-year mark, and they'll move into that status for cancellation. So this bill would allow a tax debt to sit in temporarily uncollectible status for up to 3 years. At three-year mark, it would be considered for write-off. At seven-year mark, it would be considered for cancellation.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions for Deanna? Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. I want to note that, colleagues, that this bill was originally heard in February. At that time, I think a number of us were pretty unhappy with some of the information that we were receiving about actions that involved people whose assets were exempt from execution and therefore couldn't be collected. After the meeting, immediately after that meeting, I had a brief conversation with Deanna Mack about that issue and said that I expected the department to come up with procedures and policies to deal with these issues. I wasn't expecting them to have it done this quickly, nor was I expecting that we were going to be moving a bill on this topic today. But they have, in fact, done that work this quickly, and I want to commend the department for doing that. The warrant issue, the issues with the warrant have been dealt with. And in fact, I think that warrant is in printing now, the new form of the warrant that deals with the issue of proper notice to people about what's exempt. This bill, as I see it, is our setting in clear language, clear statutory language, what the department has told us they're doing and what they plan to do, and that what we expect them to do as they deal with taxpayers in Oregon. They have a responsibility to collect the taxes that are due so that there are funds to pay for schools and health care and public safety, the other issues that we need to pay for. But they also have an obligation to treat taxpayers fairly and appropriately when that comes up. I think these this amendment, the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2089, actually does do that. I won't claim that it's perfect. I'd be astounded if it were, but it's the next version. I would also note that this is a bill that I drafted and presented to the Interim Revenue Committee in December for introduction, and I'm very glad that it was available for use for this purpose. Other discussion? Representative Reed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I was a little slow in getting to this. Looking through the amendment, and amongst the things that in Section 3, those criteria, I'm just curious sort of about the thinking and how it might be interpreted that B has less than $5,000 in assets. There's certainly some things that can that can change kind of quickly if you if there was one particular thing that represented a large portion of a person's assets. How do you think about that at a moment in time as opposed to over a larger period of time.
Mr. Chair and Representative Reed, that is something that when we met with the Georgia Coolidge and Angela Martin, who've been working on with us on this bill, we talked about setting a standard that was similar to the IRS standard that would allow taxpayers to not have substantial assets. We all threw out the number $2,000, which is what the IRS or what the federal government requires for Medicaid to qualify for that. And we all thought that that was too low. So we envision a rulemaking process that would allow us to define and clarify some of the constraints around what $5,000 of assets means, that we would include these people in that process. Because you're right, there's some timing issues, and then there's also some assets that like we would never take, like someone's heirloom wedding ring or something like that, that might very well be over, maybe it's $5,000 or $6,000, but we're not going to go seize that because there's no resale market for it. We're just not going to do that. So we envision a rulemaking process to deal with that, but would probably follow very similarly the guidelines that are set forward in the federal law, but for the amount.
That's very helpful. Thank you, Mr.
That helpful?
Yeah.
All right. Anything, before she leaves the podium, anything else for?
Just make her leave and come back repeatedly. Sorry.
Representative Vance?
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2089.
Thank you. Representative Vance moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2089. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Vance?
Chair, I move House Bill 2089 as amended to the floor with three pass recommendations.
Thank you. Representative Vance moves House Bill 2089 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? No objection. The motion carries. I'll carry the bill. We'll close the work session. Committee's adjourned. Yeah, sure.